vice president of Court Division at the time, and Charlie Beecham was his direct assistant, was aware of the difficult time we were having adapting the original Quicksilver model to the production version of the 1960 Ford car. And he kept saying to me, Joe, where are the people that did the original Quicksilver? Why don't you put them on the finishing of the Ford 1960 car that is derived from the Quicksilver? And I said, well, Jim, the people that made the original Quicksilver model are the very same people that are desperately trying to incorporate all the features of that pre-production model into this production version. But the differences are that the original Quicksilver model had with it an entirely new engineering package from the ground up, and we are working with carryover frames and old packages from the previous model, and the differences are vast in overall heights and widths and proportions of the car, and really the proportions are the key. And that finally, Jim Wright did realize in the end that it was the proportions that had such a tremendous effect in the appearance of the original Quicksilver. Now,
the Quicksilver remains a...
The Quicksilver was a successful year as a Ford car in the 1960s, but it was diluted in some of its sales by the tremendously successful Falcon. It also ate into, of course, both the Ford line and the Fairlane at the time. And so it suffered in that respect. The next car that I'd like to talk about is really one that so many people have made inquiries about and talk about and still talk about. It's the Mustang. And we in the Ford studio were involved with the final development and the final proposed model for the Mustang that was accepted for production. And what had happened was that management decided that they were not quite satisfied with all of the previous Mustang proposals, and before they would commit to a final model, they wanted to make sure that both Lincoln Mercury Studio and the Ford Studio would have had an opportunity to get proposals for the Mustang model and its consideration for production. And during this time, when the Ford Studio was finally given a request to develop a model or two in competition with the other studios, namely the Corporate Studio of Ford Design Office and the Lincoln Mercury Studio, we in the Ford Studio, due to our workload, which was the facelifts of all of the car lines that we were carrying for production, and of course the truck end of the business, we could only afford to give our maximum effort to one model. And in that one model, we also split the model so it had two sides, although the front end and the back end fit both sides. So in that sense, we had a model that served a double purpose, so we had another entry.
Was that your question?
Yes, with one model.
Again, question, what was the original impetus for having another small car at this point?
Well, of course, it was the Corvair competition.
Successful Corvair.
Successful Corvair. Right. And Lee Iacocca wanted to introduce a car that was more of a personalized sporty car, as a four-seater, rather than as the Corvair, which was a sporty, sport-type car, and a two-seater. And so we finally were given the green light to go ahead in the last months of the Mustang development. Now, at the time that the Mustang was given the green light to be developed in the Ford studio, I was called at a training area that I was in, the management training area, and where I had gone to train in a Captain Retrievo course for management. And this was a course given to all management to attend and to glean methods of operation that could be beneficial for our individual operations. So I was told that we had this new program and that the studio was rapidly putting together a model, and that I could see it when I would be coming in the following Monday. This was a week sojourn I had, and I was informed at the school where we were going through with this indoctrination for a week in like the middle of the week. So I could hardly wait. This was a management seminar, and I could hardly wait for the week to end. I had difficulty concentrating on my homework and thinking about the challenge of the Mustang. Now, the Monday that I returned to the studio, I looked at the model that had hurriedly been put together and started, and my exec in charge of the exterior design in the studio was Dave Ash at the time. And on the Dave Ash was my manager for design, who was Dale Haldeman. And I looked at the model and I said to both Dave Ash and Dale Haldeman, I said, fellas, we're on the wrong track. We can't do this. This is not the way we're going to come home with the models.
Do you remember why you
said
that?
Well, yes, the model, we had a reverse backlight, which was a sporty approach, similar to the Porsche car. And also the Anglia of Europe had this reverse backlight. And the Lincoln Mercury Studios, of course, had the reverse backlight for the Lincoln car. And in total, I felt that although the Porsche car had a reverse backlight at the time, that really this approach was not the approach that the Mustang should be in. But not only that, but the overall appearance of the design theme that was beginning to develop on this model was not, in my judgment, what the Mustang should be. So I immediately asked Dave Ash and Dale Haldeman, I said, well, just put the top on and let's get back to basics.
It was
put together with a theme that held together as a sporty type car, but in my judgment, it was not the right car for the Mustang model that I thought might win the model. So I said, let's cover it up and let's start all over.
And
well, Dave Ash was particularly concerned the effort that's gone into it. I said, well, we still have time, and we will take 1 week and rethink this problem. And we're going to re-bring scale this problem throughout the whole studio, and we're going to reassess the direction and see if we can't do much better.
Yeah, And I said, we have a week to go, we'll do it. And the modelers, incidentally, at this time, were very much upset because they had been working overtime and furiously putting this model together, and particularly to show me a more completed model by the time I returned. But it was too much, too fast, and not enough thinking. And the best thing we did was cover it up. Now, we started then from scratch, and I will have to say that some of the techniques that I had just been through in the management training course, I began to see if I could utilize some of those very same techniques we talked about and applying some of those ideas to developing some of the themes and ideas for the Mustang. So then what we did was had a brain session with all the designers and all the managing designers in the studio, and we made lists of what the cars should look like, what the Mustang should look like, and we made lists of what the Mustang should not look like and why. And we also had, to our availability, of course, the photographs of all of the other previous Mustangs and proposals that had been tried from the corporate design studio. And of course, this was a benefit for us as a springboard to not repeat some of the themes or ideas that were tried and not accepted. And we knew why they weren't accepted. So with all of these do's and don'ts, and what it should look like, and what it should not look like, and what the women would expect and the men would expect, we did a tremendous job in the studio of product planning our own Mustang. And that's what we were doing. And in that week, we then came up with the new theme of the Mustang, and I guided the front end and the overall appearance of the Mustang with the designers. And I will say that Gail Alderman was a tremendous help in helping establish some of the design feeling to the Mustang. Now, some of the men that were connected with me on the Mustang development were Gail Alderman, who was a manager in the studio under Dave Ash, who was my exec, and executive stylist directly under me, and then Gail Alderman worked for Dave Ash. And then there was Charlie Faniff in the studio. Charlie Faniff, Phaneuf. And he was a tremendous assist as well. He's a little buzzbomb with a lot of audacious ideas. And of course, like all other cars, there were quite a few people. And there was John Foster, who was also in the Ford studio as a senior designer and a tremendous contributor. And of course, with the Ford studio and the interior contributions were tremendous, with Damon Woods, who was the chief of interiors at the time. And I believe John Majar was his exec in interiors at the time. So they did a tremendous job for the Mustang's interiors. But the exteriors, the men I mentioned, Gail Alderman, Dave Ash, and Charlie Faniff, and John Foster, did a tremendous job in developing, with the rest of the designers in the studio, the overall appearance of the Mustang. Now, I felt that I contributed personally to the Mustang's appearance by, one, being able to recognize that the original model was indeed going in the wrong direction. And I felt good that after the car was approved, that the car that was approved was a result of our second effort at rethinking the problem of the Mustang. And I was very much pleased with that. And of course, the overall design theme I then guided through its development as the director of the Ford Design Studio. And I ensured its appearance, and I helped guide particularly the front end of the car with its Maserati approach, which I instilled in the front end. I said, we need a front end on this car similar in character and intense personal character like the Maserati and the Ferrari. Namely, that the Maserati, I said, has a very strong center motif of the trident. And I said, we need something like that. And we're going to have to develop a die-cast detail for the center of this rail. And we want it to have a different kind of a flavor, sporty flavor. Not necessarily with the mouth way down low, like the Ferrari, but maybe uplifted a little bit to give it a little more directional verve. So I felt very good that the direction I had established on the front end finally paid off. Dave Ash contributed with the development of the taillights for the Mustang. And he did an outstanding job in that respect. And Dave Ash did an outstanding job in helping guide the Mustang and its development with the committees, various groups that came through the studio, such as the manufacturing committees, the engineering committees, and the product planning groups. And it was a tremendous team effort that paid off. When Lee saw the car, he just rolled his cigar in his mouth. He was always smoking some Havana-type cigar, and I could see the gleam in his eye, and he was pleased as punch with the car. He reminded me of the lively appearance of the car, and it looked alive even in the development of the clay. Now, we took, as I said, a full week to establish the new theme, and then it took us another week after that, or a week and a half, to complete the clay model. So we did the whole project in just better than 2 weeks' time, which was a tremendous effort, and it shows what really teamwork can do if everybody thinks of the problem from the same point of view and getting the input in and working as a team, as a group effort. It was a tremendous success. But I feel tremendous satisfaction in having worked on so many products in the Ford and in trucks, as this particular car has been one of the highlights of my design effort.
Well, that's a tremendous episode. Perhaps as a postscript to that,
I
have a minor details currently. I seem to recall reading somewhere that the
code
name initially was the Cougar.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And what I had asked the studio to do is, I said, we need a Maserati die-cast centerpiece with an important impact to fit into the Ferrari-type front-end grille. Mm-hmm.
and I had come up with the name of the Cougar.
Okay.
And I said, let's use the name Cougar for the car, and let's design a Cougar in a formal royal stance with a raised paw on the front and in a regal position, which we will insert in this elliptical die casting in the grill. So the fellows came up with a die cast cougar that we inserted in the center of the corral. I call it corral because what happened was the die cast collar remained. But unbeknownst to me at the time, Soraya Coca and the sales people were seriously considering the name Cougar and other names for the Mustang. And finally, in the surveys through the sales market research, the Mustang name came out on top. And the Mustang horse was designed in another studio and simply inserted inside the very same ring that housed the original Cougar. So we switched the Cougar for the Mustang in its corral.
Do you remember who sculpted that?
It was sculpted by a modeler in one of the specialty studios. I don't recall the modeler's name, but he did an outstanding job modeling that particular detail.
One final question. The name
Oh yes, certainly the Cougar and the Mustang certainly had different connotations, but both names, in fact quite a few names were surveyed, and Cougar and Mustang were in the top contenders, and finally a Mustang won out over all of the contenders. But Cougar finally was used for the Cougar, for the Mercury version of the car, and so that also was used. But interestingly enough, the car fell together naturally as a design theme. It wasn't forced, it all fell in shape, all the pieces came together properly, all the components, all the exterior considerations, the air scoop on the side, which originally was intended to be functional.
Mm-hmm.
But I suspected that we couldn't maintain that for several reasons. One was cost,
mm-hmm.
and added complications in manufacturing,
mm-hmm.
and the other one was just the final potential use of the air dam back there. We were considering directing it, say, towards the rear brakes or
mm-hmm.
something of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so that eventually became a more of a decorative symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But it was important, and it was retained,
mm-hmm.
although it was not functional. The car, in its engineering development, came together very, very well. We were very conscious of all of the package requirements, and we had no time to play loosely with our requirements, so we were right on all of our requirements. The manufacturing requirements, as far as the feasibility of that model, that also fell together like a glove with the manufacturing people, and the car, from approval to the model on the showroom floor, hardly was any change at all. It was an incredible, successful design effort.
You may not think
along
these lines, but thinking back, you've had a triumph each decade that you've been with the company.
Well, I've been very fortunate to have been associated with so many successful products. There have been some that I wish I hadn't been associated with.
You like to recall them, right?
And I have cringed about them. But generally speaking, we had a pretty high batting average. The other area of the business that everybody fails to talk about, yet has been so tremendously important to Ford Motor, both from the financial return and also from the importance of the product, which is the truck business. The truck business and the aesthetics of the trucks grew and developed. With the truck design office, which was part of my responsibility in the Ford division lineup of cars and trucks,
and Mercury
Lincoln Studios never bothered with the mundane trucks, but these mundane trucks did help support the financial well-being of Ford Motor and then some. They have had a tremendous return on investment, and they have come up through the development of the trucks of Ford Motor from being a so-so truck to being number one leader in the trucking business for many years. And I feel very, very happy that I've been part and parcel in the development of the trucks, and the development of the trucks too. I've been in number one position at the time that I was heading the design for the trucks and cars for Ford Division. An interesting story was, an interesting aside on the truck development, and a truck that influenced all of the truck development in the United States and Europe was the 1957 F-100 truck,
the basic pickup.
And what was so different about this truck and the rest of the industry was that this was the first wide hood truck concept, and integrating the body side into the pickup portion. And this had not been done before, and this concept of a wide hood had never been tried before, and I felt that this would be very, very apropos to the truck line and something that we could build on in the future years for our F-100 series and the light-medium trucks. Now, interestingly, what happened here was that the dealers saw photographs of this truck prior to introduction. And again, some of the dealers were tremendously upset because this was a truck that they didn't quite understand when they looked at it because it had such a wide hood. And the number one truck at the time in the light trucks was, of course, the Chevrolet. And the Chevrolet had a conventional narrow hood. And the number one seller was this conventional narrow hooded Chevrolet truck. And here we were coming out to compete with Chevrolet with this strange looking truck. They had never seen anything like that before. And they were so concerned that all effort was made to stop the truck. And if they couldn't stop the truck, to see if this truck, because they felt so strongly, some of them, that they would lose their shirts on that truck. And fortunately for the truck, we had run out of time. And there wasn't any time to make any more changes to the truck. We'd gone beyond the point of no return, we were in hard tools, and everything was so far along that was impractical to change at this point. So the truck went into production as originally designed. And lo and behold, some of these original truck dealers, again, we couldn't find them that were complaining about the truck. The truck was an instant success and proved to be the benchmark then for all of the future trucks in the light area, in the medium, with the light hood. And immediately after that, General Motors fell into the same pattern with their next truck line. And then for years, we could feel the mimicking and the trying to catch up with the trend setting that we had established and with our Ford truck. But of course, we were pulling away then from the number one leader, which was Chevrolet prior to this truck, and we had taken over and established the Ford truck for the first time as the number one sales leader in the light area. Mm-hmm. And later on, it also became sales leader in the other part of the trucking areas, the medium and the heavy.
So it was
a 1937
model that established the successful trend, the Ford being number one in sales of the truck sales.
Yes, and interestingly enough, Ford division then broke away very rapidly from the rest of the herd and established their separate servicing techniques for the truck business and trained separated dealerships and gave truck dealerships and truck facilities for service and all the new electronics and all the thinking and engineering and Ford trucking really established itself. And the final culmination of the truck effort that I was connected with was also with the development of the heavy line of Louisville trucks. And I remember distinctly that Joe Caldwell, who was then general manager and vice president of the truck division for Ford Motor, wanted, and I distinctly remember him saying, "Joe, we need a theme for our new Louisville trucks that we can hold and build on to." And I said, "Bill, we are going to deliver such a theme for you." And we barnstormed the themes of all the trucks in the world, and we came up then with this theme of a oval with a slanted diamond-shaped front end that we carried into the body. And I said, "That is a very contemporary approach to the trucking business machine, and it should hold true and good for many years." And to this day, that theme is continuing on the Louisville in an updated version. But the theme is still there that we established in the Ford studio for the original Louisville truck. And it is so successful and going so strongly even today, and it's gotten even in the cab over engine themes and into some of the light truck front ends. And the truck was a tremendous success.
And it is still today.
Now, my exec at the time of the Louisville truck development was John Major in the studio, and Bill Wagner had, prior to that, retired after reaching age 65.
Very capable.
And who was a very, very capable designer himself, and was a meticulous manager, and a person that was superb with detail and organization, and working with the engineers and the trucking engineering requirements. And Bill Wagner was in the studio with the 1957 Ford pickup truck new theme development, and John Major was in the studio as my exec with the Louisville pickup, and he did an outstanding job. And so, really, the trucking business, we have not paid much attention to in these tapes, but they have been a tremendous growth and a tremendous success story in themselves. And they have been number one for many years. And I hope they remain that way.
Right. Did you, as a
prospect
for this, did you have any input into the development of the Ranger concept before that?
No, I did not. Not in the last Ranger at all. I left, finally, I was asked to consider an assignment in Europe to be director of the European design effort for all the European products in Europe, and what I consider going to Europe for a period of 3 years. And this was in 1968, at which time, having talked over with my wife, we thought that would be a super challenge and something that would be so different, and we could have an exciting time. And we accepted, and the children were growing up. We had two still in school, but we thought that they could continue their schooling in Europe. And we left to go to Europe, and where I assumed the responsibilities in Europe for all of the European Ford car lines and trucks interior and exterior, all the Ford European products. In Europe,
excuse me, you're being modest again. Did someone feel there was a need for a well-rounded design executive to pick up perhaps the pieces of Ford Europe and reshape them?
No, it wasn't that so much. What had happened was that Damon Woods, who his previous assignment before going to Europe was as a chief of all interiors for Ford US, and he was asked to go to Europe with his capabilities, and he was a tremendous designer and a super organization man for managing, he was asked to go to Europe as the director, chief stylist, chief designer, I should say, for the Ford of Europe. And then Damon, on one of his return visits to the States, had an unfortunate accident, and he lost his life in a car accident on the way home one night driving towards Ann Arbor at a road repair area. And several months went by, and the position was not filled, and finally became urgent that we needed someone, and I was asked if I would consider going to Europe, and I certainly accepted the challenge, and I'm glad I did. We were slated to go to Europe for 3 years, but it wound up to be 6 years. And the family, our daughter, had completed her high school in Europe, at the American School in London, and she had returned to the States to college, and our youngest, John, was still at the high school in London at the time that we returned from Europe. And both the family, the children, and they and I really benefited from our stay in Europe. And some of the car lines that I feel particularly happy with, I worked, of course, with all the European car lines and the trucks, but the successor Capri to the original Capri, I helped develop this Capri in Europe with the designers in Europe, and that was a tremendous success both in Europe and in the United States, and was imported in the United States for a while until finally the economics of the exchange rate, the dollar versus the D-mark of Germany, it proved to be more prudent not to export the Capri to the States, but to design it here. And that's what happened to the Capri. But finally, the last car that I was associated with in Europe, but before I get to that, I better brief it by saying that during my time in Europe, it was felt that the European Design Office, Ford of Europe, needed an Italian input. And I had brainstormed the idea that we ought to start a new studio in Torino for Ford of Europe.
Why Torino?
And Torino because that was the heart of the car industry in Italy, and that's where all the design work and Fiat were located, and that was the hub. And well, all the specialty cars were in that area, around Milan or Torino, and in that northern part. Right. And Ford of Europe management thought it was a great idea, and Mr. Ford thought it was a great idea, and so we started to recruit for a studio in Torino, a brand new studio, which was a tremendous challenge, because I wanted the studio to be 100% Italian. All the people in the studio to be Italian, and no other nationalities involved, to ensure that we had as much as possible a strong Italian input to our design effort in Europe. Now, the way I went about it was that I dovetailed my effort with industrial relations of Ford Italiana of Italy, the main office in Rome. And we had set up an advertising program in Torino, and I had set up dates for interviews in a Torino hotel where I interviewed designers, potential designers for the studio, potential engineers to supplement the studio with the engineering work and the modeling end of the business. And we had to secure and find a new facility in which to operate from. And so we located a building which was a food processing plant just outside of Torino, and which we rented and leased. And a strong request was made at the time by European management, particularly by Paul Lorenz, who was chairman of Ford of Europe, at the time that we buy the building. But I was a little hesitant, tongue-in-cheek, because I had really not worked with any of the people that I had recruited. I had interviewed them with the assistance of Ford Italiana as my interpreter. And I talked with all these people, both the engineers, the designers, and the modelers, and recruited all the personnel, including my managing assistant to the chief, the business end, all from Torino area. And I thought it'd be better if we at least leased it for 1 year before we put more money into the project by buying the building. So that's the way we started. And then we had everything lined up. My chief for the design of our studio was Filippo Sacchino, that I had recruited. And was Filippo is P-H-I-L-I-P-O, Sacchino, S-A-P-I-N-O. And at the time when I recruited him, he was working with Fiat and was one of their lead designers. But he had felt a little misgiving and with his career potential being with Fiat. And I was most pleased finally after interviewing quite a few people for the key spot to finally secure Filippo Sacchino as my key man. Then Filippo Sacchino assisted me, who incidentally had a plus for him that some of the others did not. He had a little smattering of English. Now, I didn't realize how much he had in school, in high school, but he had let me have quite a bit of it, but wasn't using it. And so his English was limited, but he soon became quite proficient. And then he in turn helped me then recruit my engineers and the modelers. So it was a team effort, and we finally got everybody organized and set, and it was go. We pushed the button, and the studio was functioning. And it functioned like a clock. Everything clicked. The studio was a tremendous success. And concurrent with the Ford studio that was servicing Ford of Europe, concurrently, the Ghia studio in Torino was furnishing Ford US with the same input of designs, along with full-size bodies that they had facilities for, the full-size prototypes. Now, eventually, Mr. Ford decided, and management, that this was a little too much, and that we should combine the two studios. The two studios were eventually combined, and even to this day, Filippo Sacchino, to my knowledge, is still the chief of the Ghia studio, but he is the man that I had found through my research and set up as the original chief for the Ford of Europe portion of the advanced studio in Torino.
Do I recall that the
Ghia
studio was under the general direction of a
gentleman
named
Di Tommaso? Yes, the Ghia studio was under the general direction of Di Tommaso. And the Ghia studio was purchased by Di Tommaso. And the Ghia studio had previously been owned by another Italian that, I forget his name now, but he had purchased the business from the Ghia people, and he was a car racer. And he eventually had a physical problem and unfortunately died in the U.S. at the Ford Hospital. Well, he'd come to the Ford Hospital for a kidney surgery, and that was his problem, but then he died shortly afterwards in Torino. And The man who had purchased the original Ghia design firm was Luigi Segre.
Sorry,
please. L-U-I-G-I, Segre, S-E-G-R-E. And he died, and Di Tommaso purchased the business from Segre's widow. And, of course, then the Ghia design effort in Torino was finally purchased by Ford Motor. So yes, it has been a Ford Motor design effort.
Mm-hmm.
And Di Tommaso is no longer in this effort, and Di Tommaso was involved with the Pantera development in Torino of the Ghia. At the time, he had the Ghia design enterprise in Torino. But the leading designer that is leading the design effort for the Ghia staff is Filippo Sapino, my recruit in Torino, that was in the Ford of Europe specialty advanced studio in Torino, that was integrated with the Ghia finally.
So in fact, you took this final Italian design firm and made it into an advanced ideal laboratory.
And it not only proved successful in respect to contributing ideas, particularly in the small segment and the sporty line cars of Ford of Europe, but the same group, the Ghia group, with the Filippo Sapino heading it, also contributed the nucleus for the Fiesta car, the theme for the European Fiesta car. And although this theme came from the Ghia effort in Torino, it had to be adjusted and put into production practicality as the Fiesta car of Ford of Europe. This was the Ford of Europe, total Ford of Europe effort in respect that the theme was developed in Torino, delivered to European and U.S. management in Europe to be further developed by the design effort in Europe, which I headed. And I worked for my direct boss in Ford of Europe, of course, was Jack Hooven, who was overall director of engineering and the products for Ford of Europe. And I was the vice president of Ford of Europe on the project. And when I left Ford of Europe to come to the States, the Fiesta car had been completely approved by European and American management. It was totally in the final stages of production detailing. And the car stayed pretty much as it was approved at the time that I was there. And the only details that were changed on the car were some of the details, like a little wind slip above the tailgate, or the third door of the little car, that improved the aerodynamic airflow. There's a little raised lip at the leading edge of the greenhouse, at the back edge of the trailing edge of the greenhouse, and the detail of the grille was altered slightly. Some of the trims were changed, but overall, the car was exactly as it had been approved when I finally left Ford of Europe. And when I left Ford of Europe, the gentleman that took my spot then was my chief of exterior design in England, who was Jack Kelnack, and he held on to the position then that I had vacated, and I returned to the States as executive director of production design for all of the U.S. Lincoln Mercury and Ford division cars, which I held for approximately a year or better, and I retired.
I'm not
going to
let you off that
easy.
I'd like to have you chat briefly, and then I'm going to ask you a second question about your staff that you had, your chief or executive staff that
worked under you in Ford Europe. Well, I'm glad you did, because I had missed that, and I'm glad you asked that. In Ford of Europe, when I went to Europe, I had three chiefs when I arrived. I had a chief in England, who was Gil Spear, and he did an outstanding job. And as the chief of exterior design for the English cars. In Germany, my chief was Jim Sippel, an American on leave to Europe, and he handled the European German end of the business. And Uwe Bahnsen, Uwe, U-W-E-B-A-H-N-S-E-N, I believe, Uwe Bahnsen was my chief of all interiors for Ford of Europe. And that was my team. Now, when Jim Sippel returned to the States from Germany, chief of the German car lines. He returned, and I placed Uwe Bahnsen in Germany with Ford of Europe and France.
He was German, wasn't he?
And he was German, but he was working in England. And I put him back into Germany to head the German car lines. And Gil Spear continued in England for some time, and then he too returned to the States. And I lobbied for and got an able assistant in Jack Kelnack to come to Europe. And he took over as chief of design for the English end of the business. Now, to clarify my chiefs and the way I worked, again, with my chiefs, the operations were identical in England and in Germany in respect to detailing the designs and preparing designs and submitting designs for consideration for products that would be sold both in Germany and in England. In other words, England competed with Germany for the final product that would be bought for a car line that would hold true as a body style for both Germany and England. But Germany had by far the superior equipment in the studio for doing the final detailing on our car lines. They had the finer bridges and electronics and the latest electronic equipment and the readouts for our design effort. So if a design was approved that would be used for a German body as well in Europe, then, and if it had been approved in England, then for the final detailing, I took that car and the model and we shipped it to Germany for the final production detailing. Now, of course, if the German end of the business were successful to come up with a winning model for a model that would be used both in Germany and England, mm-hmm. and it happened to be in Germany, just stayed there for its final completion. Now, we did this for several reasons. One was that the Germans had the better equipment. And two, we wanted to make sure that we had a German input into our products, and particularly if those products were to be sold on a continent, so that we could say, yes, indeed, these products have been designed and have been handled with our German end of our business here in Germany. And so that was a good political position to maintain. However, all the interiors for both Germany and England were designed and detailed in England. And so it was a rather complicated procedure, and it was complicated in many other ways. Our shows were a great Ringling and Barnum and Bailey effort in respect that we had our shows and proposals for a final selection of models to be bought by management, either in England or in Germany, which meant that the various models had to be prepared in one country and shipped over the channel, across the channel into Germany, or from Germany, shipped across the channel into England. And we literally flew models by airplane from England to Germany and Germany back to England, and we trucked models from England across to the channel and shipped them by boat and then by truck and vice versa back to England. And we had also models coming from Italy that were coming in to the shows as their portion of the presentation, and these models came in by truck.